proper legislative provision to deal with that. The second aspect relates to consenting of judgments, consenting to rescissions of judgments. There's been a new provision since, I think it is, when it was brought in the Magistrates Court in 2003, that you can consent to a rescission of judgment in the Magistrates Court, which would set that judgment aside. Now, there's no such provision in the Supreme Court Act, and that by itself is unconstitutional, as two different courts are dealing with the same issue in a different fashion. So we believe that if you are going to allow for rescission by means of consent, then the proper provisions have to be dealt with. And we've touched on a recent decision here in the Cape last year of Wolverhampton and another versus Lowe, where this whole aspect was dealt with quite extensively as to what happens to the ramifications of that judgment after it has been rescinded. Does the money get repaid to the person that paid money? And for example, that property might have been transferred to a third party. Is that immovable property then retransferred back to the debtor? Those issues were all raised in that decision last year. And so we just feel more thought has to be put into this, into these proposals that are currently before you today. So those are the two, or I'd say three main comments that I had with regard to Superior Court's bill and then also with regard to the Constitution 17th Amendment bill.
Wow.
Law Society is concerned, so we have all the different regional law societies that report to us. body of jurisprudence that's built up around its role, its new role. And then the first question, which I think is the most important question, relates to really access to justice and the costs and the time and it's going to take to finalize matters. Here in the Cape, you want to get divorced, you want to evict someone from your home, and the person has got a defense, has got past the preliminary procedure, court procedures, you can wait anything up to 3 years plus, which costs escalate, frustration, all those other aspects that go with it, and that's just in the Cape. Now we're going to go from there to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and from the Supreme Court of Appeal to the Constitutional Court. You might even have a full bench decision in between. So you're looking at years and years and years to finalize a matter. And it was just touched on by, I think it was Business of South Africa this morning, talking about labor court having to be quick and speedy and why you need to have these type of matters resolved quickly because there's an ongoing relationship. And that applies to a lot of other matters as well, the ongoing relationships. For example, a marriage. Why should you wait 3 years to get to court, to get divorced? There's no real reason for it. We're doing a fair amount of work here in the Cape to speed that up, especially since the Road Accident Fund matters have been largely dealt with the new legislation. We've put in procedures, homegrown procedures in the Cape, to speed up access to justice, to get court earlier court dates. Because quite frankly, a lot of matters settle just before you get to court, but you've got one person who's reluctant, who's digging in, and also there's the aspect of the cost. So to get back to add an extra sort of rung to finalizing a matter is going to add certainly a hell of a lot of costs, but also the delay factor will come into it. It is a lot quicker to get to the Constitutional Court. Their procedures are a lot more streamlined, and you are getting your case finalized a lot quicker than in the Supreme Court anywhere else in the country, but it's still going to increase the cost dramatically.
Right. Mr. Jeffrey, followed by Mr. Ambrosini.
Mr. Chair, some of my colleagues were thinking I was being nice to Mr. Pittman, but I was just trying to be helpful. But on the lighter note, the comment I wanted to make immediately after he made his presentation was, you know, when everybody remarked it was so brief, was that he's obviously not billing for it. but look, I think the submission is fairly straightforward. On the Apex Court issue, okay, you're not in favour of it. I don't know if you were here just before lunch, the question I asked, Section 29, 27, you know, are there any, it's a bit, I know, yeah, are there any cases, is there anything that's broken? Are there any cases that any of your members may have had or be able to refer to which they feel should have gone to the Constitutional Court but couldn't because of the constitutional requirement bar? Then on the so that I don't think you're going to answer now, but maybe that's something you could check. Then on the issue of the magistrates' court, look, the bill is I mean, you want the administration to be separate, and that is the case with a superior court's bill, and then presumably a lower court's bill. What's in the constitutional amendment is fairly, yeah, I mean, you can't, there is one chapter in the constitution dealing with justice. If you have the chief justice as the head of the judiciary, and I don't know if you're arguing that he should only be the head of the superior courts, so let's get clarity, is that what you're arguing? And that therefore the magistrate sort of lurk around, and I think lurk may be the appropriate word, lurk around separately. Is that not problematic? Or maybe let me hear you on that. And then I think your specific submissions on the Superior Courts Bill, I mean, they haven't looked at them really. They seem to make sense. Obviously, we need a response from the department. Presumably, as the Law Society, you will monitor what is happening in the committee and that response. And if you feel you want to further, if you don't agree with the response and the way the committee may be heading, then you would come back. Maybe at this point, you used to have, as an author, which I thought was very good, a parliamentary liaison person. You've lost them, the last one. Are you getting another one? And it may be appropriate to have one, particularly when we're dealing with this bill. And then lastly, on a lighter note, I note the magistrates, Joasa had said that advocates refuse to robe in front of magistrates. Are you wanting attorneys to be exempt from robing in front of magistrates too, or not?
Okay. There are a few questions there. The first one was, is anything broken? And if not, what are we doing trying to fix something?
Well, sorry, I wasn't saying that. I was just asking, is anything broken? Can you check with your members? I think if you don't...
I can check, but I think... That's what primarily why we took this view, that we don't feel that anything is broken. And if people, well, an attorney, a legal team, can find an angle, they'll find it, certainly as far as a constitutional point, and go to a constitutional point court if they can. So I don't believe that, but I can certainly look into it and come back to you on if there are any matters that got stuck at the Supreme Court of Appeal and should have gone on to the Constitutional Court and couldn't. As far as the Chief Justice being the head of the judiciary and whether the magistrates should be kept separate, we do believe that. And the
just for clarity, you don't believe the Chief Justice should be responsible for the magistrates at all?
Well, not in our committee. When we discussed it, we didn't believe that.
Then who should be? Because remember, there's no centralized... I mean, the magistrates are structured on a provincial level. Okay? So you've got no national magistrates structure. I mean, apart from the Magistrates Commission, which performs limited functions.
Yeah.
So who then should be responsible? Isn't that a problem? Have you thought
it could well
efficiently?
Be, yeah, it could
doesn't
well
it,
be.
Doesn't it? Sorry, doesn't it make? I hear your points on the magistrates. You know, not wanting, maybe disagreeing with the earlier submission this morning, but surely it's good if you're having one administration for the courts under the Chief Justice. Surely it's good for that to extend to the magistracy as well.
Look, I'm quite fortunate in that. I've been quite involved with the heads of court meetings that we've had for the last 3 years. So I've sat in on those meetings, primarily because they've been taking place in Cape Town. You do need someone to wear the hat of the magistrates, but I don't know if we've got firm and hard views on it. Maybe I should reserve that.
I think it's quite fundamental, and to my mind, it's sort of fairly obvious. I mean, you may want to separate the administration of the superior courts from the lower courts, but it makes sense of having the chief magistrate, as in the proposed amendment, head of the judiciary. Sorry, the chief justice. What did I say? Chief magistrate. Okay.
Giving them ideas.
Maybe you could look at it more, because I think it's quite a serious issue, and I just am worried. Lower Chief Justice, yeah, and then particularly, as I said, given that there's no national structure for the magistracy, it's simply on a provincial level, and given that we've got 9 provinces, the potential for harm, maybe can't think of a better word, to arise if there's not a proper administration and a proper structure.
On the, where I've been involved, it's more the agenda that we've got at the High Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court does tie in more with having to now deal with the magistrates and their issues. So practitioners in the magistrates' courts, we're quite separate, and we've been separate for quite some time as far as the Law Society is concerned, and it works well. Whether or not the Chief Justice is in charge of the magistrates, the heads of court meeting goes, we actually now meet without the magistrates being present, representatives being present. Just so happens for the last year. And because what we've got to discuss and what we've got to deal with for our members and for our issues in our courts, it doesn't really relate to issues that they have in magistrates' courts. That's the practical upshot of it. Whether you're going to have one judiciary and deal with all the courts at once, then we will have to relook at it. But that's what's happening at the moment, and it's working. I just want to deal with the other questions. The other question was related to, obviously, to a parliamentary liaison officer. I'll take that up with the society. And then the last question relates to roving, and this has actually been quite a contentious issue for my members, for attorneys, as well as for advocates and for magistrates. And it is an ongoing debate. I don't think it's something that we can really deal with today unless you want me to.
It was actually made in jest. I must also say I am an attorney, so I'm on your side. It was made more in jest, sorry. Then the issues, presumably you'll follow up on monitoring whether you have a parliamentary liaison officer or not. You'll monitor the responses to your two points.
Yeah.
You
said,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who knows? Perhaps the Honourable Jeffrey would make a good Chief Justice. But I'm going to be much shorter in length and much narrower in scope than the questions he asked. The first question, first interrogating your statement on the Apex Court. I heard the reasons you gave, but I want to engage you, if I may, shortly on the nature of constitutional justice, expressed in the expression of a different type of adjudication processes. It's not the mere expression of a legal syllogism, which relates the law to the facts and concludes with a judgment. It needs to take into account the changing circumstances of society, the broad constitutional policy, and formulate those constitutional policies. At times making tomorrow a right which did not exist today, and identifying when society is ready. And we saw that, for instance, in the TSC case, what type of reasoning the Constitutional Court took into account. So it's a different breed, a different type of work, if you wish, which requires different type of people who are generally selected on account of not only their legal knowledge and constitutional knowledge, but also on account of their wisdom, capacity to develop constitutional politics, broadly speaking, political awareness and sensitivity in respect of that which matters to the Republic. So, against this type of work, expanding the work of the Constitutional Court, effectively making it a potentially court of general jurisdiction. Does it make sense? Are these the right people for the job? Are we not losing a specialized job? How can you make a court of special jurisdiction rather than general jurisdiction, a court of general jurisdiction? I know of no case of this hybrid between constitutional adjudication and an apex court which operates by means of a certiorari procedure as the United States Court does, and it would be introduced here. Are we not creating a hybrid in which we lose the advantage of the benefits of both systems, which function very well when separated, for instance, in Austria since 1920, Italy, Germany, and Spain? First question. Second question, which is one that my colleagues are going to object to, but I've given them notice to. I'm concerned about us having the jurisdiction of processing this constitutional amendment and holding these public hearings. Indeed, my reading of Section 45(1)(c) of the Constitution, which establishes a constitutional review committee, would require constitutional amendments to be processed by the constitutional review committee within the parameters of an annual review of the Constitution, not in a piecemeal fashion as it has been done in the past 16 years, but in a holistic manner once a year, and then to be driven by from the Constitutional Review Committee, approved in terms of the reproduction of the Constitution by the NA and the NCOP. I have this concern. Is that something on which the Law Society has applied its mind? It's a matter of reading the Constitution. The Constitutional Court has not pronounced on this, so we have no guidance on the matter than our own readings, as prevalent one reading might be and as marginal as the other one may be.
Thank you. The first question relates to a specialist in a generalist court, and is it such a good idea now to move away from what is a specialist court to a general court with all the extra ramifications that comes with it? And we agree with you. We do not believe it's a good idea at all. That a good body of law is being built up. In fact, you could see from just the law reports how fat the law reports have got since the Constitutional Court came along, and we're struggling to get them into those proper binders. This whole body of law has been built up by the Constitutional Court, and we believe it's the right way, and it shouldn't be changed. With regard to the second question relating to the procedural aspect that you, I think you raised it as long ago as 2009. I only saw this for the first time yesterday. We haven't really had a chance to apply our minds to that. But I will take it back to the Law Society and see if we can maybe just liaise with you directly on that.
Just on that last point, I mean, that's not a matter that's before this committee. So obviously, if Mr. Pittman wants to liaise with Dr. Ambrosini directly, that's fine. But, Chair, I mean, that matter is not before the committee. It's like me raising an issue of what does Mr. Pittman and Law Society think of the fact that Member of Parliament in the Republic of South Africa could be a citizen of three countries. Is that appropriate? Don't you get confused which country you are actually loyal to?
No. I think Mr. Ambrosini, we've tried, honourable members, informally. Mr. Ambrosini has tried to engage with us. Mr. Pittman, you can.
Mr. Chairman, before you rule, will you allow me to speak on the matter? I mean,
you have spoken.
No, I've not spoken on the point raised. I mean,
it's
all the alternate part. I think you have the obligation to allow me to counter the point he made. He said it's not before this committee. You're making a ruling. I'm not at the opportunity of addressing you.
All right.
And I will put very... I wish to raise it as a point in limine before this committee. I think each committee has the responsibility of ascertaining what it does, complies with the Constitution first and with the rules of Parliament afterward. So I do raise the issue. If you want to rule on that, it has been raised as an issue which I would wish the committee to apply its mind on.
Well, that's somewhat of a change. You're now saying this committee must apply its mind. Initially, you informed us that you had emailed all the people that were appearing before us and giving them notes that you were going to ask them this question. So, you know, you're being a little disingenuous. Secondly, there are members of this committee who are unaware of our off-the-record discussions, and I need to inform them of what took place. Now, Advocate Holomisa, Advocate Adams, Mr. Ambrosini approached me and said he wants to raise this matter by way of a question to the people that appear before us. He believes that the Constitutional Review Committee must be the only committee of Parliament that deals with, deliberates on, and considers constitutional amendments. He has made that point to the Speaker for it to be placed on the agenda of the Joint Rules Committee. That is the appropriate place for it. Thus far, the Justice Portfolio Committee has dealt with constitutional amendments. Now, some of the members who became aware of the matter felt uncomfortable. Is it appropriate for us, having received written submissions from civil society, to then engage with them via email? Firstly, does it mean we are lobbying them? Are we permitted to lobby them? the key issue here is this is an extraneous matter. It's not dealt with in the two pieces of legislation that is before this committee. And therefore, we believe it is inappropriate for Mr. Ambrosini to have done what he did. I can't stop you, just as I can't stop you, from communicating with anybody. So that is my position. Mr. Pittman, if you feel it's necessary for you to respond to Mr. Ambrosini, I can't stop you. All right? But, well, Mr. Jeffrey has this particular view. I'm not going to go into that. And so that is my ruling. I don't believe that this matter belongs here. I believe that this matter must be referred to the presiding officers of Parliament. And if it is felt that constitutional amendments should not be placed before the Justice Portfolio Committee, so be it. We never went lobbying and asking for people for constitutional amendments to be placed before this committee. It was a decision of the powers that be. And therefore, it is a decision for the Joint Rules Committee and the presiding officer to reflect on and to come back to us on their decision. If you feel you need to comment, please feel free to do so. I'm sorry, Mr. Pittman, to make you part of this, which is essentially an in-house matter, but you're welcome to listen to it.
Chairperson, as the chairperson of the Constitutional Review Committee, I suppose it would be expected of me to say something.
I assume that
the matter doesn't really belong here at this particular time. Because I would have expected that this, if you felt that it has to be brought to the attention of this committee, it would have been brought to the attention of this committee through the appropriate procedures and channels.
Honourable Debbie Schaefer. Okay. Back to matters at hand.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Although it's not quite, because it's completely out of the realm of the submission, but just on the off chance that you might have a view on it. Have you given any thought to the recent... No, I don't have to get free legal advice. I can give it to myself. Have you given any thought to the Chief Justice issue and whether there is, in your society's view or association's view, any merit in extending the term of the Chief Justice as... I mean, we all know about last week's judgment when they said you couldn't differentiate, but the issue has come up before us this morning as to whether we should perhaps look at a constitutional amendment to provide for a longer term of office for, or a specified term of office for all Chief Justices from now onwards, as opposed to the other judges. I know I'm catching you maybe probably off, completely off guard, but if you can't answer that, perhaps your LSSA would like to have a look at that and make some submission by our Parliamentary Secretary if that's in order.
I would rather do that, and I think you know, it's quite useful now with the way how electronic everything has become to get a quick response, and that we're using with our email shots. So if there's an issue like this, we're only too happy in future as well, other issues for you to contact us, and then for us to get an immediate response to you as to what we feel, you know, on the short questions.
Yeah, I think I must convey to you what I did to others who spoke to us before you this morning, that the fact that you've already made a written submission to us doesn't mean that that's the end. If you feel there are other matters that you wish to bring to our attention related to the two bills before us, please feel free to do so. The contact person is this gentleman sitting next to me, it's Mr. Romano. That being the case, Mr. Pittman, thank you very much. We appreciate
thank you
appearing before us. No, you can't sit at the back.
name is Thembi Nkosi, born again. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Competition Commission. And I'm with Wendy Mkwanazi, who is our Chief Legal Counsel, and Obabo Dire, who is the head of our Advocacy and Stakeholder Relations Division. We are affected by the matters that you are debating today, insofar as we have a specialist court that hear competition matters, the Competition Appeal Court. And so we have confined our submissions to that, although in the written submissions, you will realize that we have generally welcomed the 17th Amendment Bill, as well as the Superior Court's Bill, insofar as it rationalizes courts and places the Chief Justice as the head of our court system. So I will not spend much time on that, and neither are we experts in practicing before the Constitutional Court itself. We do have a couple of cases that are on their way to the Constitutional Court, but that's not necessarily the court that we are very familiar with. So most of our experience will be confined with the Competition Appeal Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal. But we're happy to share our views and experiences on any matter, of course, that you may require us to do. And noting that this is a graveyard shift, we're going to rush through the presentation. We have thought that for your benefit in the slides that we've provided, we would just give you a sense of what the competition authorities do. I propose not to read through that. Honourable members can go through that. But essentially, our primary task is to promote and maintain the competition in the Republic in order to attain particular objectives as listed there. And we do this, we essentially use two key instruments to achieve this. One is merger regulation. This is where we prevent the creation of monopolies or concentration in markets. So this is a proactive tool that we use. We are also reactive in a sense, because we look at behavior in the market. This we do by investigating and prosecuting anti-competitive behavior in the market. And these are typically things like price fixing and abuse of dominance. I thought also, and you will be very familiar with this on my slide 4, I'll give you a sense of the authorities and courts that we are subject to. As the Competition Commission, we are the investigating and prosecuting body, and as I've indicated, we also approve measures. The Competition Tribunal is an adjudicative body, so the cases that we investigate, we would prosecute before the Competition Tribunal. So in that sense, the tribunal becomes like a quasi-court of first instance for competition matters. And once these parties can appeal or review these matters before the Competition Appeal Court, whose judge president is Dennis Davis, whom I understand has made submissions before on this committee. And currently, as things stand, the cases get appealed from the Competition Appeal Court to the Supreme Court of Appeal, as well as the Constitutional Court in the normal course. Now, our concern with this structure as it appears now is that competition matters in their very nature require a speedy resolution. These are often commercial matters, and by the time sometimes decisions are made by courts, the developments within the commercial environment are such that the decisions themselves example, where one of the airline companies complained nationwide. And by the time a judgment, after all the appeals, by the time a judgment was delivered, nationwide itself was no longer in existence. This is not something, I mean, even though there are a few instances of this, this is not something that's unthinkable, because if you are a small company that is, say, subjected to abuse of dominance, you are being excluded from the market. By the time it is determined that the conduct was wrongful or unlawful, it may be too late for that particular small company. So there are huge implications. This is besides the fact that even consumers themselves may be subjected to the outcomes of an anti-competitive conduct in things like price fixing that occurs. Until that is determined by the courts, there's very little that you can do to stop that conduct. So there's a very real need for speedy finalization of competition cases. And in fact, this, we believe, was the intention, the original intention of the legislature on how it structured competition authorities as well as the courts. There is also a recognition that this particular area would need specialists to deal with matters, hence the specialist competition tribunal and the specialist court that deals with this. Now, specialization is not only with respect to expertise that they have, but is also with respect to procedures that they need to be following, because there may be a need to dispense with normal court procedures for a very good reason. We notice this a lot in the case of mergers, because mergers are also commercial agreements that are sometimes subject to timelines for commercial reasons. And so the tribunal often has to dispense with the normal rules that would apply even when there is an opposition to a particular transaction. Now, in terms of the Competition Act, Section 62, subsection 3 in particular, the Competition Appeal Court is a court of final instance in respect of prohibited practices. These are contraventions of competition law, as well as merger control and processes before the tribunal. Essentially, these are all competition matters. But the Supreme Court of Appeal's jurisdiction was retained with respect to constitutional and jurisdictional disputes. This was the scheme, and this is from the plain reading of this, the intention of what the original intention of the legislature. However, in various decisions, the Supreme Court of Appeal has, under the doctrine of inherent constitutional power, declared that it is empowered to appear all to hear appeals from all specialist courts, including the Competition Appeal Court, where special circumstances permit. We can provide you with details of that decision if that's required, but this is a case involving the Competition Commission and ANZAC, which was a confirmation of a decision that the Supreme Court of Appeal had taken in labor matters, where NUMSA was a party before it. And so what essentially the Supreme Court of Appeal said was that on special circumstances, there would be an opportunity to appeal upon special leave granted. So you would have to appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal itself, and they could hear those matters. And I must add that in practice, this has proven to be a very easy step to do. It's not very difficult to get a special leave from the Supreme Court of Appeal to hear appeals from the Competition Appeal Court. And so the effect of this we would submit has been sidestepping the original intention of the legislature, which was to make a competition appeal court a court of final instance with respect to competition matters. It has added another layer in the hierarchy of courts that could hear competition matters and contradicts the underlying policy objective to ensure the speedy resolution of competition cases. I will not make a long motivation on that because I think the committee the committee's proposal, we think, remedies failed to indicate that once again, what we have also seen from practice is competition cases have become highly litigious. I think as more as competition authorities are becoming more effective, as the stakes are getting higher in the words of some private attorneys with huge fines and so on, you're beginning to see a lot of litigation. And the nature of this litigation is litigation that's on technical issues, usually procedural issues, issues relating to, for an example, whether the commission has the power to investigate, how it can initiate investigations, how it can collate information, and that sort of thing. Very few cases, I can think of only one, that's been decided on the merits. So fundamentally, the litigation seems to be playing the role of preventing cases from being heard on the merits. And I don't want to make accusations about whether that is intended or not, but that's certainly the reality. And so we welcome these bills insofar as they resolve what we certainly think is a long-standing legal lacuna facing specialist courts in that it allows for speedy resolution of cases whilst not taking away the right of parties to appeal. All what it does, as we understand it, is it eliminates the step of appealing at the Supreme Court of Appeal. We are by no means suggesting that the task before you is easy. I think the intentions are very noble, and we would support that. The complexity the complexities are such that even the competition authorities themselves, policymakers, they have to look at their own statute, the Competition Act, insofar as it needs to be rationalized to be consistent with the amendments that you are doing here. The appeal provisions as appearing in Section 62 and 61 of the Competition Act essentially create some kind of a dual system of appeal. With respect to competition matters, the Competition Appeal Court is a court of final instance. And your amendment, as we understand, is previously also proposed by Judge Dennis Davis, deals with that in the sense that the specialist courts are now in a position where they can finalize matters. It's very difficult to sort of look at this in terms of the strict hierarchy of the courts as envisaged in the normal litigation processes, but certainly it seems that what you're doing is to make a court which has the status of the High Court, which is the Competition Appeal Court, to be a court of final instance, and we believe there are very good policy reasons for doing that. What it leaves us with is Section 61 and 62 in our own statute, the Competition Appeal, the Competition Act, which provides that the constitutional and jurisdictional disputes must be appealed at the Supreme Court. Supreme Court of Appeal. We would suggest that there needs to be consideration by policymakers, certainly the legislature, to look at the possibility, and this is what we would recommend, of eliminating that step. Because what you now would possibly have with that step is, again, a possibility of going to the Supreme Court of Appeal for this constitutional matter, which can still go to the Constitutional Court. And that will still, although you would have eliminated a big part of the problem, that would still perpetuate the possibility of elongating matters that could be finalized quicker. And as I have indicated, there's a very good chance this may happen, because a lot of litigation that's happening now is on technical issues that could be easily looked at as constitutional matters. So whether the commission has issued summons appropriately, or whether a particular rate was within the confines of the law, and that sort of thing. So these are all matters that potentially are constitutional. And so we may, and we thought we would indicate this with you upfront, so that if you hear that there is a debate happening with the Economic Development Portfolio Committee, which deals with the Competition Act, you might be able to talk to them as well about this particular issue. That certainly is our. We certainly think that it helps to get the Constitutional Court to hear these matters once and for all if they do arise. And we've proposed that insofar as you may want to see how we envisage this, maybe we could provide you with more submissions on that. We didn't want to jump the gun. We wanted to tell you what our thinking is. Otherwise, we once again want to express our delight in that you've undertaken this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bonagale. I recognize the Honourable Dean Smuts, followed by the Honourable John Jeffrey, and then Mr. Emerson.
Thank you, sir. Firstly, the Competition Commission has suffered reversals at the SCA, not so. Were they on issues not just of the jurisdiction of the competition authorities, but on actual competition issues? Because you reminded us that upon a certain interpretation, the SCA has heard appeals on competition issues. Now, what I am not clear on is whether you are telling us that these bills as published already resolve your problem. What you would like to see is that the SCA retains only jurisdiction of competition authority cases, or are you saying you want to skip the SCA altogether? It's not clear, especially as between your presentation and this written submission. Is this written submission from Judge Davis, or is it also from the Competition Commission? I've heard reference to a submission from Judge Davis. I'm not sure I have it. So, some clarity, please. In your presentation, you say that the bills allow for speedy resolution of cases while not taking away the right of appeal. It eliminates the SCA step in the system. However, that is not what the written version says. The written version says the SCA should have jurisdiction in matters.
put the spotlight on the specialist courts. Because just in response to Ms. Spence, I mean, you've still got to respond, but in response to her question, I don't know if the 17th Amendment and the Superior Courts Bill really make any change. In that, for example, the new, the amendment to 168 is the SCA may decide appeals in any matter arising from the High Court of South Africa or a court of similar status similar to the High Court. That presumably would be the CAC, because you've got a judge as the head of it. And then the Supreme Court of Appeal may decide only, number three, any other matter that may be referred in circumstances defined by an Act of Parliament. You've read your Act out to say it does actually say you go to the SCA for jurisdiction and constitutional matters. So, to my mind, it's not really solving your problem. I mean, I think your problem needs to be solved, but I don't see the bill as doing that at this point, because I think you would still, although you've still got, you can't get, if you're wanting to get rid of the SCA, I don't think this is doing it, and you're going to be going to the Constitutional Court anyway.
Yep.
So you've got that other leg. But I think, Chair, for me, it's an issue, and then I noticed that in the schedule to the Superior Courts, amendments that affect the Labour Court. There's no amendment to the Competition Act. And I think it's a general concern, even when we look at the broader question of the Apex Court. What I find interesting is that you say there's now a similar provision being put into the Constitutional Court to hear matters that they want to. There's a broad thing of public interest. You say that is already there for the SCA to hear your matters, and the SCA readily agreed to, or is readily agreeing to hear your matters, which was my fear with that provision relating to the Constitutional Court, that who passes by the opportunity to exercise power when offered it. But I think we've got to do more work on this. I mean, I think the issue for me is, what are you? Okay, the CAC. Presumably you are a other court, as referred to presumably you're covered in section or clause 170, clause 6, the amendment to section 170, all courts other than those referred to in 169, 168, 169, you're not on any of those, so you must be then another court in the amendment bill. But then, are you the section I've read from the amendment to 168, are you a court of a similar status to the High Court? I would assume you are, because you've got a High Court judge as the presiding officer. But I think it may be useful just getting more background information. I mean, presumably the tribunal is not a court, it's a tribunal, that's why it's called a tribunal. The appeal court, do you only have one judge, or do you have other judges? I mean, maybe I can just get a quick answer on that one.
We have three.
Okay. And then one is the head, and that's Judge Davis. Okay. Because you do also need to, you know, you need expeditiousness, but I mean, if we look at the Walmart Massmart issue, I mean, the issues are highly complicated and have major impact. I think that to me your submission has highlighted the fact that there's a problem and we need to do more work in trying to resolve it. I mean, the one aspect individually that I feel is that it may be better, and it's I don't know how it's going to go with other bodies, it's just a flyer at this stage, but it may be neater to have all the courts dealt with together. Okay, so Labour Court into the Superior Courts Bill rather than the Labour Relations Act. And similarly, it's a question I'm putting to you: should the issues relating particularly to the selection of and the administration
of the CAC remain in your act, or should it come over to superior courts? Because are you not superior court? Although the superior courts bill doesn't talk about you and doesn't amend anything, but it does talk about the labour court. But you know, that's why it's a question of what are you. So, Chair, I don't know. I apologies to the committee with one exception, but to the other members. I've been sort of just thinking aloud. But I've been doing it from the point of view that the competition people can commission can actually look at it. But I think a lot more work is needed with regard to them.
All right. Mr. Emerson.
I have the benefit of thinking before I talk. Don't aggravate matters, Mr. Emerson. I'm just saying that's what I do. I first think, then I talk. So I can be coherent, which is something I would highly advise to many people to learn how to do. But let's start from what seems to be the understanding. The system of the antitrust, anti-competitive adjudication requires expertise and expedited adjudication. The CSE is made by the statute to be the end of the road. Then on general principles, inherent jurisdiction, constitutional matters, etc., two additional labels have been taken, or possibly two additional derivatives, two alternatives have been made available to the Court of Appeals and to the Constitutional Court. How does this bill impact what we're doing? First of all, let's look at the Section 6, because I think the Honorable Jeffrey did not read the complete section. This is six. No, I got a different, sorry. Yes. The Supreme Court of Appeal may decide appeals on any matter from the High Courts of South Africa or a court of status similar to the High Court of South Africa, which very likely this is. Except where an act of parliament provides otherwise. Question, the bill is sustained, considering your act, which you know much better than I do, would this parenthetical not exclude the application of this amendment, in that your act, I would submit, provides otherwise, or intended to provide otherwise, so the status quo would remain. Question one. Question two. If we look at the function of the Chief Justice as the head of the judiciary with the function of ensuring the uniform application of laws and the establishment and monitoring of norms and standards for the exercise of the judicial function in all courts, and that's usually understood is relating to uniform interpretation of principles, of norms, as well as the way one goes about doing it. If that function is located in the Chief Justice, and if the Chief Justice is in the Constitutional Court, and if the Constitutional Court has the power of dealing with anything by means of certiorari, would that not mean that the Supreme Court of Appeal being excluded, all the issues that the Supreme Court of Appeal deals with it now, as technical as they are, would go to the Constitutional Court, and we would end up having the Constitutional Court dealing with anti-competition issues, which in terms of the legislative schema require specialized technical knowledge and expedited adjudication.
Thank you, Chair. May I respectfully refer honourable members to slide 5 of our presentation, because I think it's going to clarify a lot of the questions. As I understand, the amendment that is being proposed
appeals to the Supreme Court of Appeal, but there is an exception, which is where it says save where otherwise provided by an Act of Parliament, as pointed out rightly by the Honourable Ambosini. Now, that section is what gives gives a possibility to eliminate the Supreme Court of Appeal. It gives that possibility because if you read on our slide one, on our slide five, the third bullet, section 62, subsection 3, and that statute provides that section provides that the CAC is a court of final instance. So this is the statute that is envisaged by your amendment, where it says save where otherwise provided by an Act of Parliament. So this would be the Act of Parliament that eliminates the necessity to appeal with the Supreme Court of Appeal. So in a sense, that helps a lot, especially insofar as there might be disputes that are not constitutional. So a lot of disputes of fact and so on will then be resolved in the final instance at the Competition Appeal Court. What honourable members are right about is that it doesn't take away all the problems, because insofar as you have constitutional and jurisdictional disputes, our statute doesn't say those must end at the Competition Appeal Court. It says they must go to the Supreme Court of Appeal. So in other words, there will be these two steps for those particular types of disputes, that is the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. And I merely made the point that it may be worth looking at that as well, if not now, later, whether those particular disputes cannot be speeded up as well by requiring that from the Competition Appeal Court, those appeals can be made directly to the Constitutional Court instead of the Supreme Court of Appeal. Because in any event, your amendment, the effect of your amendment is to eliminate the Supreme Court of Appeal. I think most of the questions were around that matter. I don't know if I have missed any, but my colleagues can help.
The Honourable John Jeffrey, followed by Mr. Ambrosini.
Chair, thanks. Look, I mean, your act as it's okay. You'd eliminate the FCA claiming inherent jurisdiction. You then have to amend your act to exclude the FCA. But now, presumably, I don't know when your act was passed, but the Constitutional Court was always the court of final instance for constitutional matters. So presumably, there was a reason that Parliament had for providing for appeals to the FCA first. Now, the question we need to be looking at is, well, whatever the reason was, is it working? Presumably it was some kind of screening mechanism. Okay, I don't know. But then you've got the problem of jurisdictional disputes, which you if you want to cut out the FCA and say constitutional matters go directly to the Constitutional Court, unlike before, do you also want the Constitutional Court to deal with jurisdictional matters? That's sort of the one difficulty I've got. I don't know if you can divide it and say jurisdictional matters to the FCA and the Constitutional Court can hear them if they want to. But then I'm a bit worried about your saying that the Constitutional Court must hear jurisdictional disputes arising from the CAC.
No, I would suspect that the CAC gets a first bite at jurisdictional issues. But obviously, first, in terms of inherent jurisdiction, the Supreme Court of Appeals would have the power, but if it not excluded it, because it told us it would be excluded by this proviso. But the real issue that concerns me is the stare decisis, the decisis, however you want to say. Once you give the Constitutional Court the function of ensuring the uniform application of norms within the legal system, any half-decent lawyer different. The decision is too different to be not to violate the principle of equality. And there, bang, the Constitutional Court gets involved in something which, under the guises of being a legal issue, forces them to deal with the most complex matters of economics and antitrust and competition, which the legislation tried to insulate because of their complexity from the rest of the legal system, although the judiciary, and leave in a specialized court. And this is an issue that we are facing in respect of this subject matter, but I think it would apply in respect of any other subject matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem is that there is a complexity around eliminating the Supreme Court of Appeal, in that it was meant to be a layer that sifts matters and distill what would you could distill from there what would be purely constitutional matters, which would then go to the Constitutional Court. The problem of eliminating that level, I would agree with the Honourable Jeffrey, is you have all sorts of disputes around jurisdiction. Although jurisdictional questions are often constitutional questions, but you have this problem that you will have no forum where those could be aired, especially if there would be instances where they are not constitutional. So I would concede that would be a problem. But it's something that we thought we should share with you as a thinking. It's certainly something that we would be taking to the committee on economic development. But it may be worth that you then also talk to them about their thinking insofar as that statute is concerned. We certainly. We wouldn't prescribe how Parliament processes the legislation if all those courts are provided in this bill or in a separate specialist bill. It doesn't really matter to us. But what seems to be important is that at least you understand the implications of your amendment to the existing specialist courts. I don't know how much you've debated the implications on the labor courts, but from my knowledge of the labor regime is that you have a possibility for stakeholders there participating in the selection of judges themselves, and you have two courts there. You have the normal labor court, which is a court of similar status to the High Court, and you have a labor appeal court, which is a court, in terms of the decisions of the Supreme Court of Appeal, that's below the Supreme Court of Appeal, which seems to us like an appeal division of the High Court. So you have that problem that the hierarchy is disturbed, and we certainly do acknowledge that, and we want to point that to you so that you are aware as you do that. We submit that there are very good policy reasons why you should do that, but you should be very aware of the implications and how they will be resolved, if not in this bill, in another format. It may well be that the proposal that is being made to make the Constitutional Court an apex court for all matters would address some of these concerns, in that you would now, any appeal that would come from the Competition Appeal Court can find a forum where it could be heard. Constitutional or otherwise, but I would want to add a caveat there that we certainly would agree that the right to appeal to the Constitutional Court should be limited in some ways, and we've not considered all the implications of the qualifier that's been proposed here. But certainly, we wouldn't want a blanket right to appeal to the Constitutional Court. But it seems there might be merit to preserve that right of appeal, if not on constitutional matters, if not only on constitutional matters, certainly subject to a very strict
to that court, which is a good sign, because it means again the policy objectives will be achieved of having the court of similar status as the High Court being the court of final instance.
Increase the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court, which is what the bill is doing, and you cut out the SCA, which is what you want, you're going to have the Constitutional Court with a heavier workload, which means that dealing with your matters, competition matters, expeditiously will be more difficult. So just a comment on an observation on that. But I do think it would be useful to engage a lot more for the commission, to engage a lot more with the committee on the bill. Bills.
All right. Mr. Monagella, you and your delegation, we thank you for your submission and for making yourselves available for today's hearings. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, that effectively brings us to the end of today's hearing. If I could just address myself to the bills before us, quite obviously there are weighty matters, and as we've said to people like Mr. Monagella and others before him, they should take advantage of making further submissions. The person to liaise with is Mr. Romano, and those will be considered. As to whether there will be further hearings like we had today, I can't say. Mr. Radman and Messrs. Skusana Delanga et al. Where is trafficking?
says we would like to hear from other specialist courts. So we heard from the competition court. I would like, and I'm not sure whether other colleagues have the same need, to hear from the constitutional court itself and whether they have a reading. The constitutional court now has got its own department, so it's not necessarily represented through the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. I think it would be important to have the head of the Department of the Constitutional Court, or the head of the Department of the Chief Justice, however it is characterized, to give us his or her sense of how the additional responsibilities will affect the court and how the court would cope with it.
Thank you very much.